Joining us on this Medical Monday is Dr. Jennifer Michaels, Medical Director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County's largest community mental health agency. Dr. Michaels is also Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts. She's board certified in both general and addiction psychiatry and has been in practice for over 15 years. Jennifer Michaels, what a pleasure to have you here, to see you again. I mean, I must say, as soon as you come on the show, every phone rings off the hook because everybody has somebody they know with an addictive problem or a mental health problem, and the calls are never ending. And then when people yell at me at the end of the show and they say, I couldn't get in, I'll say, that's because you didn't call in the beginning of the show when you really have a good chance. In fact, I believe that we are a society that has been addicted to procrastination, which is a curse, don't you know? Think of all those people who waited to the last minute to write that paper before the next morning when the sun was coming up and they realized they thought they had it licked, but they didn't because they hadn't put the bibliography in. And that took way too long. 1-800-348-2551. So how serious is our addiction problem in the United States right now?
I feel it's very serious because I am hearing about it from neighbors, friends, desperate patients. What I'm seeing is a lot of opiate pill use, and it starts out very innocently. Pills look legal, but taking them for a high is illegal, and they're potentially fatal. You can overdose on these pills.
So what is an opiate pill, for example? What names do they go by?
Good question, Alan. We think of Vicodin, Percocet, oxycodone. They even come in fentanyl patches. There was a time that they came in lollipop form, believe it or not, for very sick people. They were able to suck on a lollipop with opiates inside so that it could be released. But they're so ubiquitous, so available, that we actually see a flooding of the market.
How do you get addicted? In other words, I had a doctor friend a long time ago who got addicted to Percocet. He had neuropathies. He was diabetic. And he started on this thing. And pretty soon, he was really in bad shape.
Well, I first want to say that some of the nicest people I know end up addicted. It's not bad people. It's just a bad disease. But often it starts very innocently. It may be that someone has a pain syndrome. They're written for prescription meds and they take them. And then even after a month of taking these medications regularly, your body adapts and expects the medication. And when you try to stop, you go through withdrawal. And that fuels the desire to take more pills.
Wow. We'll go to Linda in Albany, 1-800-348-2551. Linda, you are on. You're on now. Go ahead, Linda.
Okay, hi. I just have a quick question about what you would recommend for treating mild depression in adolescents.
Okay, Linda, this is a good question. A lot of times we think about pills right away, but for mild depression, sometimes talk therapies are just as beneficial. There is a treatment called cognitive behavioral therapy. And this is a method that helps people to look at their cognitive distortions, their thinking distortions. I'll give you an example, like, no one will ever like me. You know, that's very common when people are depressed. Cognitive therapists will help that teenager look at that distortion and then create a rational response. And it's almost a reprogramming of depression to happier moods.
How do you know when you're depressed?
You know, a lot of people don't know. A lot of people, and that makes me very sad because people will come to my office and say, I'm just lazy. They'll self-label themselves as I'm lazy, I'm no good, I can't think straight. And these are classic symptoms of depression. You may feel guilty. You may feel that you wake up tired in the morning. And sometimes these people show up at their primary care instead. Fortunately, you know, as we destigmatize mental illness, more and more people understand what depression is.
Do you really think we'll ever do it? We'll ever destigmatize it?
I hope so. I mean, you know what helps me a little bit is I think about breast cancer. I remember being a resident at Bellevue and women came in with the most advanced cases because they were so ashamed that they had lumps in their breasts and they came in, you know, really at the end of their lives. because they were so stigmatized. Many times mental illness has been like that. People don't come in early. But I think with education, and we need some spokespersons. We need a few people who have had mental illness who bravely go out there and let it all hang out.
Yeah.
And I think it can change.
Okay, I hope you're right. Linda, thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much. Okay, let's go to Tim in Guilderland, 1-800-348-2551. Tim, you're on.
Thanks, Alan.
Sure.
As always, she is a great guest.
Isn't she? She's wonderful.
She is.
Oh, thank you.
And my question is, actually I have a two-part question. The first question is, does rehab work?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The sort of sub-part of that question is, do you have empirical statistics that will show that rehab works?
Okay. It's complicated because people go for rehabilitation for a variety of substances. Longer-term rehabilitation, a program that lasts 1 year or 2 years, has shown efficacy compared to someone who is out on the streets and perhaps going to meetings. We do see that with programs like therapeutic communities. It can be very difficult when someone is poly-addicted. Shorter treatments have not been shown to work. Sending someone to the hospital for a week of detoxification, sending them home, almost 90% of people or more will relapse. Putting someone in a program for 3 months or more makes it more likely that person will be sober. So there is data out there. It's complicated. Tim, do you have a question about that? Are you looking at a specific program?
Well, no. My issue is that I find it hard to believe that spending a week or 3 weeks or 2 weeks or a month in rehab will change your life. You have to change your habits and behavior and conduct, and I do not know that rehab works. But mm-hmm. You know more about this than I do.
Well, there's rehab that's 2 weeks long, and there's rehab that's 2 months long. So I would say that a rehab that lasts for months is more efficacious than a rehab that's 2 days or 1 week or 2 weeks. I agree. It's a challenge to change behaviors. And the other goal would be to transition the person from rehab to, quote-unquote, civilian life over time so that they can use their success in rehab as they transition into their previous life.
Well, there doesn't so much of it have to do, Jen, with the way in which the outside stimuli continue.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, let's say you have a deprecating husband or wife who does nothing but cut your legs off all the time, and, then the circumstances that lead to this addiction may remain. How do you ever deal with changing the outside stimuli?
It's a great question. And if you look at a program like AA, it talks
sure.
about people, places, and things.
Yeah.
And people, places, and things can all provide triggers. Whether it's a spouse who cuts you down, places, every time I turn the corner, I pass my favorite bar, or things. Maybe it's every Monday morning going to work and people are nasty there. Some of it you can change, some you can't. But even just being aware, you can work on relapse prevention.
Tim, we got five people behind you. We thank you so much.
Thank you for your call, Alan. Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Thank
you.
Bye.
Let's go to Andrea in Hopewell Junction. Andrea, you're on.
Hi. I was wondering if the doctor could talk to using alternatives and natural foods instead of pharmaceuticals. My experience and friends' experience with antidepressants is that when they try to go off of them, they get very depressed because the body stops manufacturing certain things to become dependent, mm-hmm. whereas supplements such as 5-HTP or foods like millet that provides serotonin in other ways are more beneficial. And I'll just hang up and listen to your response.
Well, usually we wouldn't let you do that, but we're going to do it today because the line is so bad, okay?
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to lose you.
No. Okay, no, thank you very much for calling.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Bye.
Andrea, this is a really good question because many people would like to get off their medication, and then they try to taper and they don't feel as well. First of all, I would recommend you do this with a physician. If you've had three distinct episodes of depression, chances are you will get depressed again if you try to taper off. Does that mean that you have to stay on your medicine for life? No, it means that, you know, stay on it for now and build a rich, rewarding life that minimizes your risk of relapse with depression. That may include intense exercise, healthy foods. Very important. I assume you've done this. Look at your vitamin D level, and Alan will agree with me. I know he's a vitamin D maven. Mm-hmm. Also, we're finding out that fish oils have antidepressant effects. And you can Google online, look at fish oils and dosing. And that's another thing you can do. Sun exposure early in the day helps if you have seasonal mood disorders. So there are things you can do. I worry about using a supplement sometimes instead of a medication because they're not controlled by the FDA. And so we really don't know.
Haven't been studied.
Yeah, they haven't been studied. And we don't know that what you're hoping you're getting is actually in the pill.
Yeah. Thank you so much. We are going to now take a very short break. But if your name is Ann or Nancy or Kelly, you stay right there.
Support for WAMC comes from Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York. Identity Eyewear, it's what sets you apart. EYEdentityeyewear.net. The Blue Bonnet Diner, Northampton, Massachusetts, since 1950, offering breakfast, lunch, and dinner, banquet facilities seating 150, banquet menus, bar services, and dance floor, bluebonnetdiner.net. Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York. Sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche, qfcc.com. And the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences of all ages for the Capital District and beyond. 518-580-8080.
And we are back with the wonderful Dr. Jennifer Michaels. She's terrific, as our callers have been saying today, and we appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551. We got two free phones, and we got three blinking away. So here we go to Anne in Scotia. Anne, you're on.
Yes. Hi. First of all, Alan, thank you for doing this show. I really appreciate it. I have what I'm not sure is a comment or a question, but I would like the doctor's reaction to it. I've had depression for 20 years, and even though the stigma seems to be lessening, it's still very great. And in fact, I haven't shared my situation with all of my friends. And I'm just wondering, when people do find out I have depression, you know, the comments are pull yourself up by your bootstraps and things like that that are not very helpful. And I tell them that, you know, depression is a brain disorder. So you wouldn't tell someone with epilepsy to pick themselves up by their bootstraps or just smile or whatever. I kind of think of the, you know, things that go along with depression, the sadness, the loss of interest and that kind of thing as kind of a side effect to the real chemical imbalance that's going on in your brain. So I can get off the line. I just like to hear the comments from the doctor. Thank
you. Stay on the line.
Okay.
Yeah, Anne, I feel for you. I have other patients I treat who suffer with this. It's like a double whammy because the disease causes you to suffer. And then if you, quote unquote, out yourself, the way people treat you can also cause further suffering. Mm. I think there's ignorance. Part of it is mental illness tends to be abstract. You know, there's no x-ray, no blood test. I think also the symptoms frighten people. And it, you know, it does have that kind of puritanical work harder, you'll feel better quality of response. I think that they're also very common. So people have mental illness in their own family. We also can take a stand and say, get over it and educate people and create a tipping point. So enough people will talk about it that it becomes the new norm.
Well, don't you think now, with everybody having bipolar and getting treated for this, that to some degree, you know, things are getting a little bit more better because, you know, we now have meds that treat this stuff and people will announce and everywhere they can that they're on these meds and the rest of it. So it's not quite what it was before.
I agree. I think it's better. I mean, 100 years ago, people got locked up. And a spouse could say, my you know, wife is crazy, and get her institutionalized, and she would stay there.
And that's all of those mental health facilities in New York, for example, which you passed, which are empty right now.
Yes. So I think it's better, but this is not the end point. We need better.
Could I ask just one last question?
Sure, of course.
I'm just wondering, would it benefit lessening the stigma if instead of referring it to mental illness, which is not tied to an organ, really, mm-hmm. to say it's a brain disorder? Or would that not make any sense?
I think it makes sense. I mean, I think it may be a little confusing because there are brain illnesses like epilepsy. But, I think some people use chemical imbalance.
Mm-hmm. I think associating it with the brain, you know, so that it's an organic problem, people can think of it more, not in terms of the behavior that you exhibit when you have depression, but in terms of something is wrong, not going right in your brain. If you say chemical disorder or whatever, at least they're associating it with the body function and not, you know, the things that go along with depression.
Well, you know, Anne, you may be right. However, I did study this when I was working on my doctorate. I mean, that's what my doctorate was in, politics and mental health. You can change the nomenclature, but those people who are being cruel and picking on people will always follow the new nomenclature. So that while you may well be right, it may be a good idea, it also runs that risk of, people coming right along and saying, oh, yeah, and just continuing to do that bad behavior.
You know, you're reminding me, I heard a program maybe on this station yesterday.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, because I listen all the time. And it was a discussion of the word queer and how that was used to stigmatize homosexual people.
Sure.
And at some point, homosexuals said, yeah, we're queer. I don't remember the expression, something about we're queer, we're here, get over it.
Well, yes and no, because let anybody else on the outside use the word, you know, queer, or the N-word when black comedians use it all the time about themselves and stuff. You wouldn't want to be there when that happens.
I agree. It's complicated, and it speaks to where we are now, that we haven't found the right nomenclature, that we haven't fully destigmatized these illnesses.
Yeah. Hey, Anne,
thanks. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. And Nancy in Pottown, Poughkeepsie. Nancy, you're on.
Yes, hi, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Would you comment on the prescribing of Effexor for perimenopausal insomnia, mood changes, and depression? My quandary is that one gynecologist in my practice is recommending that, and the other gynecologist is recommending a hormone, progesterone, and the use of 100 milligrams of 5-HTP, because he says that eventually the body will want more and more of the SSRI of the Effexor, and that the dose would have to keep on going up. So I would like your opinion on that.
And Dr. Thanks. Michaels, if you would be kind enough to sort of let us all in on what's going on here.
Sure. Perimenopausal time, women often experience insomnia, sweatiness, anxiety, irritability.
What does that mean, peri?
Around the time of.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know. Well, around the time of menopause.
Yeah,
yeah, before, during, and after. And so sometimes medication helps. And antidepressants are typically used. So are hormones. What was just mentioned, though, that you will become tolerant to the effects of Effexor, which is, by the way, an SNRI, just to complicate matters. It works on serotonin and norepinephrine. Versus Prozac, which is an SSRI, it works on serotonin. That shouldn't happen. People who are treated with an antidepressant often will get on a good dose and stay on that dose. In a small minority of cases, the dose will be escalated. But usually, you just get on the good dose and stay on that. As far as what you should do, I think, Nancy, whatever you feel most comfortable doing and whatever works for you. Effexor is one medication. Being on, I think you said, progesterone and 5-HT, two medicines, it may be easier just to take one medicine.
And do you, in your experience, do you have an idea of what the recommended amount of time or average amount of time for women to be on the Effexor or other medication is at this time of a woman's life?
it's on the order of years, not months. And, you know, a year to 2 years would be what I would do with a patient of mine. And it wouldn't be a short treatment of a couple of months. And usually with antidepressants, we think about at least a year of treatment.
Mm-hmm. And normally, do you start at the 37.5 milligrams and go up, or you know, do you leave them at the lower dose?
I usually go up to about 75 milligrams, and that's a doubling of the lowest dose. And then hopefully they have symptoms in remission. If they don't, then I'll go up even further. There is a risk of increased blood pressure as you increase the dose. So, Nancy, if you do take Effexor, have your blood pressure monitored.
Are we finding that these drugs are getting better? Because there was a point at which, as I remember it, there was some real concern about taking the drugs.
About safety?
Yes.
You know, I think we weigh the risks and benefits, and there is some concern in general that we don't see 100% benefit.
Uh-huh.
You know, we see a significant proportion of people getting better, but some people don't respond. And so, you know, my goal would be that someone take medication, but also look at lifestyle changes, dietary changes, and kind of create a whole package.
Well, now you've got my interest. What dietary change could one make for this time of life?
Black cohosh.
What's that?
It is an herb or a tea that may be used. Some people will take soy products, which mm-hmm. have a little bit of estrogen, which has been helpful to avoid. You know, I always say it's bad to be prejudiced in any way, but with your food, be prejudiced. Avoid white food.
Ooh.
Because simple carbs, white foods like sugar, breads, pasta, can do damage to your insulin balance.
True.
So that's another thing to look at.
That's right. Nancy, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Kelly in Albany. Okay, Kelly, it's your turn.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi, Alan. Hi, Doctor. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling to inquire about the biochemical connection between alcohol dependency and the brain. It's become obviously common knowledge in the medical community that alcoholism is no longer just an issue of self-control, but rather an addiction that one is predisposed to genetically. And I didn't know if the doctor could perhaps explain this connection between the genetic predisposition in layman's terms.
Okay. So I will make an attempt to do so, Kelly. So we know that some people are genetically predisposed to alcoholism before they have their first drink. There have been many studies that have looked at this. And what we see is that young people initiating alcohol use who are genetically predisposed enjoy alcohol more. They have more of a euphoric effect, which makes them more likely to keep drinking. And they also have a lower effect when it comes to feeling intoxication, like nausea or dizziness. So those two factors, they like it more and they have less negative effect, increases their risk. And the other thing to think about is that as a group, they have low endorphin levels. What normalizes their endorphin levels? Take a guess.
Alcohol.
So think about endorphins, which, you know, are our feel-good neurotransmitters. A subgroup of young people have low endorphin levels that will go to normal levels if they only would drink. So this is a model for alcoholism. And so it's very hard for them to feel good unless they're drinking. Does that help you? It's more complicated and there are many other factors, but help you?
It does, and I was just wondering if it had any direct connection to the levels of serotonin. I know that oftentimes alcoholics may be prescribed certain SSRIs or certain SSNIs, mm-hmm. or even from the family of the PANs, the diazepam, clonopin, etc. Mm-hmm. Is there any connection there with the levels of those hormones or neurotransmitters and the dependency factor?
You have done some research, I hear. Yes, and it comes to light when we look at subtypes of alcoholics. So there are subgroups of alcoholics. Some are more avoidant. Some are more likely to start early and to be what we call novelty seekers. These are the thrill seekers who drink at an early age. And that subtype tend to have low serotonin metabolites in their brain. And this subgroup may benefit from a serotonin type of medication. But as a whole, if we just experiment and give every alcoholic a serotonin medication, we don't see a benefit. Subgroups, those novelty seekers, may benefit from a serotonin medicine.
And in conclusion, do you think that there's any chance that one day there will be technology which would be able to measure the level of serotonin or don't want to butcher the pronunciation, but norepinephrine, in someone's brain so that they don't have to go through the trial and error of different anti-anxiety medications and rather pinpoint the one that would best suit their ailment?
Yes, I love that idea, and I think it will happen. We are currently doing PET scans, which show area of activity, glucose metabolism. We are able to identify chemicals like serotonin and norepinephrine in the brain. We're not quite there yet.
Okay. Well, I hope we will be in my generation or the next generation's lifetime. Thank you so much for your time and insight.
Thanks,
okay,
Kelly.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551, and we're off to Monica in Pittsfield. Hey, Monica, you're on.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a quick question. We are talking about depression, and I'm just wondering, anxiety, as I've read, usually goes together with depression, and specifically what I'm talking about is PTSD, and I have been reading online. I've come across some info suggesting that a medication called Marinol, dronabinol, which is THC, is being either looked at or researched or considered for the treatment of anxiety or even cannabis dependence. And I wanted to know what the doctor thought about that. And,
okay, great, great, Monica. Here we go. Go ahead.
Okay, Monica, so you mentioned Marinol, which is, for people who may be surprised about this, Marinol is actually THC, one of the active ingredients in marijuana. So THC is a legal medication prescribed as Marinol in pill form. This is typically used for people who have lost appetite or have pain issues, but we're now experimenting to see if Marinol is useful for psychiatric illness. And studies that are very small, that don't have a big number of people involved, have shown possible efficacy. I feel that there's much more research that has to be done. But it also speaks to how desperate people are and that some people want those experiments to occur so they can see if THC may be helpful. This is also happening in the area of opioid treatment. So, for example, someone with depression may be treated with something called buprenorphine, an opioid, to see if maybe that helps depression. It's not what it's supposed to be used for, but we're experimenting to see if it does help.
Understand. That's an off-label use.
Exactly, off-label. Yes, that's what we call it, off-label use.
I understand. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Monica. And we'll go right on. We're using up our time. Let's go to Anise from Wilbraham, where everybody owns a pig. Anise, you're on.
Oh, hi, Alan. Hi, doctor. Thanks for taking my call. This is certainly a complicated issue, and I love the discussion. So helpful and informative. I was prescribed a medication called citalopram. And this was a postmenopausal effort to help with sleeping and insomnia. And that was about a year ago. And now I find in trying to wean myself, well, with my doctor's help, off of the medication, it's very difficult. I went from 60 to 40 to 20 milligrams for 2 weeks respectively and still now have occurring problems with a kind of a zinging sensation that's mm-hmm. going on in my brain. And I wonder if indeed this will go away in time, or should I be weaning myself in another effective manner?
Very good question. First, you're not alone in your experience. I see people who are struggling in the same way, and it is a zinging, almost electrical sensation people have in their head or their arms or their legs.
Right.
And my recommendation in that situation would be taper more slowly by 10 milligram increments instead.
Uh-huh. Okay. 10 milligrams then for how long a time period?
As long as it takes, you know, there's no rush.
Takes.
Yes,
okay.
You could lower by 10 milligrams every 2 weeks or once a month.
Okay. So can I take it as needed? Would you suggest that?
No. It's the kind of medication to taper off over the course of a month, 2 months, or 3 months.
Okay. So it may take that long.
Anise, thank you so much for calling.
Thank
Appreciate
you so
it.
Much.
Yeah. Okay.
Alan, take care.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
You too. We have to take a short break. Seconds. Just seconds, I tell you. There's one free line. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from the Hudson Valley Heart Center, providing cardiovascular care throughout the Hudson Valley with services including nuclear, echo, CT, angio, and vascular testing to help evaluate cardiovascular wellness. HVHeartCenter.com. Snow Farm, Williamsburg, Massachusetts, a New England craft program offering creative arts workshops taught by master craftspeople for adults and teens, beginners and up, snowfarm.org. Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center's Graduate Program in Social Work and Graduate and Undergraduate School of Nursing at St. Francis Hospital in Poughkeepsie, hosting an open house Tuesday, May 1st from 6 till 8 p.m. Adelphi.edu/Hudson Valley. And Curran Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York, providing legal and consulting services to life insurers in a changing regulatory climate. CurranCompliance.com.
And we are back with our wonderful and giving and charitable friend, Dr. Jennifer Michaels, medical director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County's largest community mental health agency, and a woman who tends to, and a doctor who tends to answer questions both in terms of her medical knowledge and her deep humanitarianism, which I really love. Okay, so let's go back. We have five phones, so we're going to try to get everybody in. So that means keep your questions short, and we'll try to keep our answers short, okay? So let's go to Allie in West somewhere. Okay, Allie in West somewhere, you're on.
Hello, hi. I'm calling because I have a previous diagnosis of depression and bipolar disorder, but I've been prescribed medication, but it's in remission and I've been medication free for about 2 years. The only time I really experience symptoms is like during my period. I have a lot of trouble getting out of bed in the morning. I'm very tired, have crying spells that just can't stop, and just kind of have a pervasive depression. But I'd really like to avoid going on any kind of medication on a permanent basis. So I was wondering if you could recommend anything just to treat these symptoms as needed.
Well, one thing I'm wondering about is what about taking medication just before your period? There are women who benefit from an SSRI the week prior to menses, and then once they get their period, they stop the medication and they don't take it again until a week before their next menses. It's a bit of a compromise, but you won't be taking medicine every day.
Okay. The reason I stopped was really to just avoid, you know, negative side effects of mood stabilizers and psychiatric meds. So anything that, as long as it wouldn't build up in my system enough to cause these negative side effects.
Well,
in the short time.
Sure, this may be a way to do it. And something very important to realize: not taking medication may cause symptoms and side effects. So some people I've worked with people who just don't want to take a medication no matter what. But it's important to realize the stress, the trauma of having very significant psychiatric symptoms can cause an effect. So we got to balance that out between, you know, avoiding medicine and then suffering with symptoms.
All right. Thank you very much.
Hey, Allie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's go to Jordan in Saugerties. Jordan, you're on. Go.
Hi there. Fabulous conversation. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Interesting comment about depression being a stigma. I think addiction is also a stigma, and it's considered lack of willpower as opposed to a chemical imbalance. My question is about alcoholism in particular. I was reading a book by Roger Emiasson who talks about baclofen, and that alcohol, one of the great cravings, the cause of the cravings, is the GABA imbalance caused by the alcohol. And I'm wondering about the topic of the pharmaceutical solution to addictions in general, and specifically baclofen, if you've heard anything about that, all of which, of course, flies completely in the opposite direction of the AA-type therapy.
Okay, now we got a lot of people lined up behind you, Jordan, so we're going to go real quick. Okay, doctor. Okay.
Baclofen works on the same site in the brain as alcohol, but works differently. There are some medications that can help the motivated alcoholic to diminish cravings. Baclofen doesn't currently have that indication, but there's Revia or naltrexone and acamprosate or Campril. They're not the cure for alcoholism, but they can help a motivated person with cravings.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks,
thank
Jordan.
You.
Yeah. Okay. And we'll go to Betty in Plattsburgh. I love to hear from Plattsburgh. Way up there, full power station, WAMC, and Betty's listening. Betty, you're on.
Okay. Thank you. I have a very close friend who has bipolar disorder. At least that was the diagnosis about 8 years ago. She recently has been diagnosed with carcinoid cancer. And if I can believe her, her current psychiatrist has suggested that her carcinoid cancer has been causing her bipolar symptoms. And I want to know simply if that's possible.
I think that's not very likely, but I don't know the specifics of her disease and if the cancer is secreting certain hormones. Sometimes people will have mood changes because of a cancer that secretes hormones or chemicals, so that can
mm-hmm.
happen. But I really don't know enough about your friend to comment appropriately.
Well, but Jennifer, can't a really tough life threatening situation make one worry enough so that strange things can happen?
Well, I think the stress of severe illness can lead to other events. I think that's very true. And, you know, we see the stress of losing a loved one.
Sure.
And then 3 months later, that person develops cancer. I think that's true.
Or dies.
Yes, we do see that.
Yeah.
Yes. And we even know in certain cultures, and I think it was in Haiti, when a hex was placed on you and you were told that you were going to die.
Yeah, you died.
You died. So we know that, you didn't fake it.
Mind body.
Yeah. So it can be very powerful, the mind-body connection.
But Betty, I'm not the doctor. All I am is sitting here. But it seems to me that the kinder you are to your friend, the better off we all are.
I think that's great advice.
You know what I
you
mean?
Are the doctor.
No, not at all. Thanks, Betty. Appreciate it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Right. And we'll go to Ivan in Albany. Ivan, you're on.
Thank you so much, both of you. A question that I've just come on lately to your program, but is there any help you can offer a family member who has another family member with diagnosed depression over many, many, many years? Is there anything that can help convince that family member that this is not a lack of willpower or character flaw, rather than a let's call it a chemical, if not a better word, as a disease?
Hmm. So you'd like to help to educate this family member about what depression truly is? Is that
exactly
correct? You know, there are many famous people who have suffered from depression. William Styron is one person that comes to mind. Dick Cavett. There are people, Kitty Dukakis. And it may be useful for him to read what other people have suffered with and to realize it's a valid disease. Or maybe go online and to Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services of America or administration, and you can read about the disease of depression. And there are even studies that look at brain chemistry and brain scans that validate that this is a true brain disease.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at, yeah. Is there any evidence of that nature that it is truly a brain disease? That would be very helpful.
You can go to SAMHSA, S-A-M-H-S-A. Okay, if you Google that, you'll go to a clearinghouse of information available to anyone curious about mental health issues and substance use disorders. Very accurate information.
Give me that one more time, please, Doctor.
Sure. S as in Sam, SAMHSA.
Got it. Thank you so much.
You know, it's such a good question when you think about it, Jennifer, because you know, that's just the way it is. I'm always thought back to, during the fun drive, we always played the 2,000-year-old man. And there's that point at which he interviews somebody named Dr. Haldanish. And Doc, it's not really doctor, but Dr. Haldanish. And he says to him, what's the worst case? A guy who sat in the corner and all he did was to tear paper. They said, well, did you cure him, doctor? He says, I did. And he said, how did you cure him? He said, I said, just stop tearing paper. And he listened. Well, the humor is there, but it also gets directly to Ivan's point, which is that people have short fuses when it comes to this, and they don't have the same kind of empathy that they really ought to, which is this is something that that person can't control.
Yeah, and I see it again and again, and it's not a matter of intelligence or knowledge. I think it's ignorance of what they're seeing, or maybe fear. I don't know, but I have seen it many times.
Fear and ignorance. I like both of those.
Yeah.
Ivan, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate
You're
it.
You're very welcome. This is very helpful. Yeah, thank great. You both. So
thank
much.
You, Ivan.
Yeah. Let's go to Mary in Albany. Mary, you're on now.
Hi, Alan. Hi,
hey.
Dr. Jennifer.
Hi.
Quick question. I have been diagnosed with bipolar 2 for almost 10 years now. I take Lamictal, Zoloft, and Trazodone. I just had to increase my Zoloft. And I wouldn't want to do without my meds, my psychiatrist, and my therapist. And I'm considered stabilized. However, my husband will attest to the fact that marijuana really helps balance me out. It's incredibly therapeutic, and I feel it too, but my husband sees it even more than I do.
I was just going to say, I can't wait to hear Jennifer Michaels on this, because she is not a big fan of marijuana, but here's a possibility marijuana becomes a palliative agent.
Yeah. Well, my psychiatrist, he obviously can't say yes, but he did not advise against it.
Jen?
It's very complicated, the marijuana question, because there are components of marijuana that have therapeutic value. I am concerned, though, that marijuana over time, instead of treating anxiety and depression, it can do that short term, can precipitate symptoms. It's kind of comparable to people who smoke, who say, I smoke and I feel more calm, I feel relaxed. And it's true. For the short term, these medications will work. Just like if I have a glass of wine, it relaxes me. It's wonderful. I go home from work and I have a glass of wine and I feel really calm. Long-term effect, I'm a little more concerned about. If your use escalates or you have more anxiety, so you have to smoke more, I would be concerned about that.
Well, I wonder what the trade-off is. I just had to up my Zoloft. Would it be better to just have a little bit more marijuana? I do not have a lot, really.
Okay,
not
Mary,
at all.
I'm voting for the Zoloft, but that's
okay. And the studies have yet to be done to bear it out. Is that right?
Yes, and we're starting to look at it. And also, I should say, marijuana has so many different chemicals in it. I feel concerned when people tell me I take marijuana, I use marijuana for anxiety, depression, headaches, when we really don't know what they're taking. And I would feel much better if we started to study it and could tease out the beneficial effects and make sure people don't have the harmful effects.
And you won't be arrested for Zoloft.
And yes, we promise not to send the police to your house if it's just the Zoloft.
Hey, Mary, thanks for the great call, Mary.
Thank you. Love the show.
Yeah,
okay. Bye.
Let's go to Sharon in Queensbury. Everybody's playing by the rules there. Go ahead,
Hi.
Sharon.
It's a good crew.
Yeah. Go ahead, Sharon.
Hi. I'd like to also ask a question about chronic depression and what the treatment might be. And I know that there's sometimes alcohol abuse with us to alleviate the anxiety.
Yes.
The person involved is on an SSRI.
Okay. We see a lot of searching for a medication for chronic depression, chronic anxiety. What we know, though, is that what we call a biopsychosocial approach is most beneficial. The biology is the pill, but the psychology piece is just so important for someone suffering and not getting full resolution with the pill. We think about things like dialectical behavioral therapy. It's a very structured, strong treatment, a talking therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, CBT, that cognitive therapy I mentioned before, and also changing lifestyle, having different social interactions, which can be challenging when you don't feel happy. But sometimes they act as catalysts for change in other areas. So the biopsychosocial approach, medication, therapy, and then social changes. That's really the full gamut of treatment that we recommend.
Could you repeat the word biosocial?
Sure. Bio, mm-hmm. Psycho, so biological and psychological, biopsychosocial.
And how do you change lifestyle? I mean, like, for example.
Okay, I'll give you a simple example. Sometimes when people are depressed, the one thing they really want to do is stay in bed. And it's so attractive, so compelling. They give themselves that. They'll stay in bed till 10 or 11. But if they could just do that one thing, wake up at 8 o'clock every morning, that could potentially be a catalyst for other change, like maybe exercise or meeting a friend for coffee at the corner. So that would be the social component, changing your lifestyle. Maybe you're not going to commit to a complete transformation, but change one thing and see what happens next.
Hey, Sharon, I wish I could give you more time, but I really do want to try to get everybody in.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling, Sharon.
Thank you.
Let's go to Marie in Albany. Marie, you're going to be our last call. Go ahead.
Okay, hold on. All right, you got me?
So far, so good. We got you.
Okay. Question is, if in elderly people, like 70s, 80s, and I do home care, and I'm running into people who are depressed and anxiety, but every time you listen to the ads, they tell you that the similar medications don't work as well or work opposite for elderly. Is there something, what should I do?
Okay, tough question. Marie, that's a tough, good question. Often depression and anxiety go hand in hand. There's something called agitated depression. People who are depressed but can't sit still, keep worrying. So they go hand in hand. And it's interesting that SSRIs, serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors, treat both depression and anxiety. Cognitive behavioral therapy treat both depression and anxiety. So they often co-occur and can be treated at the same time. I hope that's helpful.
Well, the hardest part is how do you get somebody who is in their 80s who wants to get into some kind of a therapeutic thing, and they just want, some of them just want to die. And that's really what's hard. And I know I've seen a lot of people who have lots of benefits from therapy and stuff, but I'm having a hard time getting them to go.
I don't know if you have a program where the therapist can come to the house, but... it's very challenging trying to help an older person with feeling of still having integrity, autonomy, their place in the world. It can be very challenging giving them medication, structuring their day. It's not hopeless. It can take a lot of different facets to make it work.
But, you know, I have seen examples. Mm-hmm. I've seen examples of which somebody who is hopelessly depressed, mm-hmm. an older person, mm-hmm. Takes the medication and makes all the difference in their lives. They turn around when they thought it was impossible. But I mean, really, night and day. So that if you can get past that stubbornness about not taking medication and the rest of it, it can make a huge difference.
Yeah. It can be life-saving. I mean, that's what I love about the work I do is that it's not removing a gallbladder, it's not doing heart surgery, but to help someone enjoy life again, you know, really reclaim life is just wonderful.
Well, okay. Thank you so much.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Okay. Well, I wish we had more time. We really don't. We're leaving one person, Jean from Poughkeepsie, on the line. And Jennifer Michaels, I want to thank you so much. I'd love to see you doing a regular program like our health show on mental health here on WMC. Maybe we could figure out how to do that. I do appreciate your coming and the incredible amount that you bring to all of this. and to all of your work in Pittsfield, which is not the easiest place in the world to work these days.
No, it's not. It's a hurting place right now.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
We're out of time, everybody. My apologies to the one person we left on the line. I want to thank Jennifer Michaels of the Breen Center for being with us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. Health-quest.org for locations. Thanks to our brilliant engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks also to Daryl Bart for answering the phones. Our producer is ubiquitous Patrick Donges. Again, thanks for joining us on the Vox Pop on tomorrow's program. An open forum with somebody, either me or Ray or nobody. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.